All right, so nominally we're in lesson 40, the time draws near, but actually we're also going to look at a little stuff that would really tend to go back to lesson 39, though it's not going to be really lesson 39. I'm going to probably be all over the place today. Note that we continue to expand our area that we're looking at. Okay, as I think about things, it's more likely that we'll look at things that are more related to lesson 39 than anything, but because I wanted to pick up some of the history. I wanted to pick up some of the history because we're really a little bit slim on that, I think, as far as really knowing what's going on here. We've talked about Philip of Macedon, we've talked about Alexander the Great, and then about how things sort of divided up. I wanted to look at that a little more carefully because we had been discussing and couldn't come to the conclusion whether the kingdom of Alexander the Great divided up under four different reigns or two or 12 or what. So I did some studying on that. And then as we look through some of the passages in the non-biblical book of Maccabees, we saw that there were some people mentioned. And it talks about the Seleucids, and also, I don't know the book of Maccabees, but we've talked about the Ptolemies in Egypt. And as we look back at the prophecy in Daniel of the four kingdoms, we realize that at this particular time, we should be talking about the Greek kingdoms and the onset of the Roman kingdom. As a matter of fact, that's what lesson 40 is really addressing, is the onset of the Roman Empire, Roman Kingdom. But we've seen a lot of mentions about the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, and we've mentioned people like Cleopatra and Mark Antony, both who are in the Ptolemaic Empire in Egypt, and we've talked about Antiochus Epiphanes or Antiochus the Fourth, who was a Seleucid, and he was the one that was creating all the havoc in the land of Palestine. So I wanted to look at this just a little bit more closely. And what I've got is that I've got, you know, our all-time favorite Wikipedia up. And I wanted to start out just with Alexander the Great, because there's quite a large discussion about Alexander the Great there, but when we get right down to the division of the empire, that's where now we're looking at things that have to do with what's going to go on in Palestine and what leads to Antiochus the Fourth or Antiochus Epiphanes. So when we look at the division of the empire after the death of Alexander the Great, as he mentions, Alexander's death was very sudden. He was in the city of Babylon where he was going to establish his capital. And at that time, he just became sick and died within like less than 2 weeks. There's been all sorts of hypotheses as to whether he was poisoned and such like as that. And one of the comments that I read in this book about the ancient Near East was that, well, they had a propensity, rather, to kill off their kings. So one might think that indeed he didn't die of natural causes at the age of 32 or whatever it was. But as we look down here in this last paragraph, especially in the last sentence right here, the successors of Alexander the Great, the Diadochi, were the ones that divided up, and notice what it says, the Hellenistic world. And so it is, as we're speaking of, the Grecian Empire. So we realize that Philip of Macedon, who was whose dad?
Alexander.
Alexander's dad. He did a lot, essentially, to unify the Greek city-states of Greece, essentially by taking them away from the Persian king. And so Darius the Third, I think it was by that time, was the one that he was able, Philip of Macedon, was able to sort of cast back a little bit into the out of the Grecian peninsula area and back here at least into Turkey a little bit, so that the Grecian empires or the Grecian city states were more together and able to be more independent. But so Philip of Macedon nominally became sort of a ruler over the Grecian empire, though it's very loosely called an empire. So anyway, he died rather suddenly also, so which might make one think that dying suddenly runs in the family. After he died, then there was all sorts of rivalry between the generals of Alexander the Great. And there were apparently four main generals. And so they fought and such for about 40 years before they sort of divided it up into four power blocks. The Ptolemaic Empire in Egypt, the Seleucid Empire in Mesopotamia and Central Asia, and that's the one that we're concerned about specifically, the Attalid Empire in Anatolia, and the Antigonid Empire in Macedon, which is just in northern Greece. So if we look at those, we realize that the Antigone dynasty, for example, in Macedonia, notice that it says it was a dynasty of Hellenistic kings, descended from Alexander the Great's general, Antigonus Thalamus, the one-eyed. So I'm not sure whether that eye was right in the middle or what, but so apparently something happened to Antigonus there. So he was the ruler of that dynasty. And it doesn't go on for very long. If we look down here at the kings, there's only about, you know, six or eight of them down there before they're done, and the Romans kind of come and take them all over. And then if we go to the Attalid dynasty, I keep thinking about the time when we were over in Egypt and they would run the American TV program Dynasty, but of course it was narrated by British people. It's called Dynasty, so I keep wanting to say Dynasty. So once again, now the Attalid dynasty was a Hellenistic dynasty that ruled the city of Pergamum after the death of Lysimachus, who was a general of Alexander the Great. So that was another area that was ruled by one of the generals. And so that was sort of a kingdom, or not an empire to speak of. Yes?
Where's that area?
I've got a map here. See if I get to the right place. I did. Wow. let me see. Oh, great. Yeah, I'm going to have to reboot everything when I'm done with this. Are we up? Okay. So this map is in German, but it'll be all right. So here's the Macedonian Empire here. So that would be the first one that I mentioned, whatever it was. Then the Antigonid was this one right here. Seleucid Empire or dynasty or whatever was this big one right here. And it's the one that Mickey referred to several times. Last time it's Assyrian. And because it went down here into Syria, it sort of started, and the kings kind of set up some capitals in Syria. And then the Ptolemaic dynasty is down here. You notice that it encompasses some of the Palestine area, but that the Seleucid Empire also encompasses some of that. So see here you have the Schwarzes Meer, the Black Sea, right? Okay. Black in German, Meer means sea.
What's that?
Between the green and the yellow, what's the green?
Here's Macedonia, and then next to that is where the...
Here?
Other
this way?
Yeah, what's that?
That's the one we were talking about, whatever one it was. The
Attalid
dynasty?
Yeah,
the problem is that now that I've got this PowerPoint thing up, I've got to do weird things in order to get back to my desktop, I think. Yeah.
Practice your German.
See, I'm... no, I have to practice my German.
So the short answer is that each one of the kingdoms of the Greek Empire were had come originally from the generals.
Yes.
That were under Alexander.
Cute picture there. Let me get the display. Is it display? Connect to a projector. Duplicate. Okay. All right. So, yeah, unfortunately,
the German here says, I can't see what it says. This says the Reich of Lysimachus in orange is this one right here. And I can't see what that says. But the purple here is the Ptolemies, and the yellow is the Seleucids. And so this other one here is, what's his face? What did we call him?
Attalid, the Attalid dynasty here. So,
how long did it last?
Not very long. Yeah, it says one of Lysimachus's officers took control of the city in 282, and then they turned it over to the Roman Republic in 133. So, not very long. It was the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemaic empires that lasted for such a long time. The other two were rather weak, and they sometimes combined with the with the bigger empires to battle a few people here and there. Let me try this. That didn't work. So let's forget about it. We get back to it? Okay. Oh, we got back to the wrong thing. Okay, I'm going to get aggravated about this just any time. So here we go. All right. Don't touch it again. All right. So this didn't last very long. Where is it? Attalus the First proclaimed himself king in the 230s, following his victories over the Galatians. So we'll remember Galatia in what we call Asia Minor or Turkey today. And they ruled in Pergamum also. So all of this is Asia Minor stuff. So you should recognize some of the churches of Asia Minor from the Book of Revelation here. So we got Galatia, we got Pergamum. but after just not too very long, the Roman Republic took over. They, of course, were in the way of the Roman expansion just like right away. So even at the time of Alexander's death, Rome was starting to expand. All right, and then we have the Ptolemaic dynasty, and that was a big one. So Ptolemy, who's down here somewhere, Ptolemy, one of the seven whatever bodyguards who served Alexander the Great's generals, was appointed satrap of Egypt after Alexander's death. And so that's actually what they were going to do. They have the name of this guy. There was a guy that was an aide to Alexander the Great, and he attempted to, his name is not on here, he attempted to appoint satrapies, about four or five of them, for people to take over after Alexander. And that's then what started this sort of war between them all that lasted about 40 years, and then they just divided things up among themselves the way that they wanted after they executed the guy who divided the things up to begin with. So it's really quite interesting to read about this time span, because there's a lot of people coming to power and a lot of people dying suddenly, and the changes of kingdoms and things like that. So, but the Ptolemies were very influential. They were the ones that essentially took over Egypt from the pharaohs. Now, one of the things that the Ptolemies were intent on doing was Hellenizing the Egyptian Empire. And they did that. But at the same time, they became Egyptized also. So after a while, we see that the Ptolemies are not shown just in the normal Grecian type statues, but they're shown in headdresses and paraphernalia that have to do with what we historically think of as the pharaohs also. And so they went and sort of ruled the empire from a bit of a popular stand. It was interesting to note in reading about the history of the Ptolemies and the history of the Egyptian pharaohs and stuff that they had a tendency to intermarry quite a bit their own sisters and brothers. So as we see here that Ptolemy the First, otherwise known as Soter, and the name means something and I didn't bother to remember it. Pardon?
It said Savior on the previous page.
Savior. Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, okay. So he married Bernice or Bernice of Egypt, and I believe she was his sister. I'm not positive. I have to go back and look at it. I've just read too much of this lately, so I'm not sure who did what. But anyway, and then after Ptolemy probably died suddenly, then Philip decided to marry him and marry her also. So they had kids and all the way down here. But anyway, you see that there are a number of Cleopatras down here. So here's Cleopatra the First and the Second and the Third and another Cleopatra, but it's called Selene the First. And here's Cleopatra the Fourth of Egypt and so on. It goes down all the way down to the bottom here where we've got Cleopatra the Seventh, Thea Philopater. Cleopatra the Seventh is the one that we know as Cleopatra. Oh, a lot of these things, what happened was is that the people, when they were born, they had a regular name like Joe Smith or something like that. But when they became king, then they took on a name, much like the Pope does when he becomes Pope. He takes on the name of somebody special or such like as that. And so they do that. So these people weren't necessarily named Cleopatra and Ptolemy and not too many different names in here. Bernice or things like that. They took on these names. Once they became rulers or higher up. But this Cleopatra here, she's the one that we're talking about. She was around in just the double digits BC. So like in the 60s, something like that, BC. And here you see Mark Antony. Mark Antony, he married Cleopatra, but also Ptolemy the 14th married Cleopatra. And apparently Ptolemy the 13th also married Cleopatra. As I recall reading about her, her husband had a tendency to die suddenly also. So there was really a lot of bad health going on in these areas at that particular time. But Mark Antony and Cleopatra did their sort of best to try and hold off the Romans. And after a while, just had to give it up to the Romans. So at that time, Egypt became an occupied territory of Rome. Randy?
What's the time period we're talking about here?
These go from like 330 BC up until about 60 BC.
Okay.
So it's a rather extensive dynasty.
240 years?
Something like that, yeah. So they were around about as much as the United States has been around already.
That's what I was thinking. I'm looking at the rulers there.
Yeah.
You know, those rulers, I'm guessing, ruled a while. Some of them ruled others.
Some of them had rather short lives, but yeah. Like I say, there was, a lot of illness.
They had a lot of asps there, too.
Yes. There are asps just crawling around all over the place, biting people. Yeah. So, and then finally, the fourth one is the Seleucids. And these are the ones that we're more interested in because this is where Antiochus comes from. You see that the Seleucids started off, of course, with a guy named Seleucus, whose name was Antiochus. No. Anyway, Antiochus and Laodice had this youngin named Seleucus the First Nicator. And so then it continues on down through the chain. And so by 170-something or other, we get to Antiochus Epiphanes down here, the one that we know and love so much, right here, between, he was king between 175 and 163 BC. So that's during the time. The things that he did are the things that made the Maccabees get up and revolt. And an interesting thing that we don't read about in a lot of these books, and I don't know how to take it from the secular history books, they said that, some people said that what was going on in Judea at that time was not so much the Greeks trying to be evil to the Palestinians, but rather a civil war going on between the traditionalists of the Jews and those who wanted to Hellenize. So when we talk about the Hellenistic Jews that we see in the New Testament, we realize that those are people that had adapted Hellenistic culture, the Greek culture, and had adapted to a large extent the Greek language. And they had one thought about how things ought to go, and then there were the traditionalists that wanted to hold on to all the law and such alike as that. And it is felt by some that Antiochus III, the Great, his dad, and Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, and some of these others, that the reason that they really came into Palestine with such a heavy hand is that they were trying to put down a civil war. Now, it's obvious that these folks did not have a lot of respect for the Jewish people because they went in and profaned the temple and all that sort of stuff. And as got boxes and lines diagram with 40 boxes. Yeah. And that one of these other guys, after Antiochus IV, either the fifth or Demetrius, one or the other, he came in later on and went into Jerusalem to sort of clean things up and just walked into the Holy of Holies, apparently. So there's a lot going on here, but we see that the empire, as it were, of Alexander the Great was divided up into four generals, as it were. And so we had four kingdoms or empires or whatever: the Antigonid, the Attalid, the Ptolemaic, and the Seleucid. And the Seleucid is the one that we're most concerned about, even though the Ptolemies and the Seleucids were always battling back and forth. And who was right in the middle? Israel was right in the middle. Because the Seleucids, if I were to be so foolish as to bring that map up again, that causes my computer to do weird things, you see that they had all the northern part where Babylon and Assyria were, and the Persians. And then the Ptolemies had everything down in Egypt and over into Libya and a few other things, and then they just battled back and forth. Every once in a while, some of the kings of either empire would sort of get together with the kings of the other empire, and they try to make a pact with them so that they could push off another enemy that was coming in. Later on in the time of the Seleucid Empire, an enemy came in from the east, from the India area, and took away a lot of the eastern provinces of the Seleucid Empire. You'll remember that there was, when we were studying in the book of Daniel, I didn't look this up specifically, but when we were studying in the book of Daniel, you'll remember that we talked about that part of the things that Daniel was talking about was when the daughter of Egypt was given to the king of the Seleucids, and it doesn't mention the Seleucids, and Daniel mentioned it by something else. The king of the north, I think it's called. So the queen of the south or some such was to be given to the king of the north, and so there was supposed to be a political marriage right there, which didn't turn out too well anyway, because these people didn't really get along. but there was a lot going on in the years after Alexander the Great's death, and the real beginning of the Roman Empire's thrust into the eastern territories. David, did you have your hand up, or you're just wiggling your hand around? Okay. So I wanted to bring that up just so that we have some idea of what we're talking about here, when, if you were to read, for example, in the book of Maccabees, which I have open here somewhere, if I can find all these icons open. So if we look, for example, just in 1 Maccabees, it talks about, you know, they talk directly about the fact that we're talking about Alexander, the son of Philip of Macedon. He reigned in Greece. He came out of, he'd overthrown Darius, king of the Persians and the Medes, and so that was Darius the Third, not the one that we generally know about. And so there's a lot of mentions about things that we've talked about in this historical book of Maccabees, first and second books of Maccabees, that talk about this particular battles and things that were going on in the land of Palestine. We also talked last week about this thing that today the Jews know as Hanukkah, and was mentioned by Josephus apparently as the Festival of Lights. And I think here in the Maccabees they refer to it as the Feast of Dedication. And but one of the things that we had commented on, but I couldn't find in the book of Maccabees, is that they seem to show that this Festival of Lights is one that's supposed to mark a miracle that occurred. And so what was the miracle that occurred? Well, it turns out that so-called miracle that occurred is not mentioned in either the first or second book of Maccabees. And it turns out it wasn't until about 600 A.D. that someone came up with the idea of the miracle of the oil. What was the miracle of the oil? Anybody remember? Yeah, the story varies from place to place and things like that. In this book here that I've been using as the extra biblical historical reference, he mentions that the Maccabees had actually taken back Jerusalem, and they were going in and they were cleaning the temple out. And as they were cleaning the temple out, deciding whether to throw this away or keep that and everything like that, they realized that they needed to keep the candle lit the whole time. Well, they needed to have oil that was purified. In other words, it had to be ceremonially done by the high priest and all. So apparently they looked around in the temple and all that, and all they could find was one jar that says sealed by the high priest or something like that. And so that was only good for one day. And so, well, they poured that oil in to light the lamp for that day. And they say it lasted for 8 days. And so that was the miracle of the, supposedly, of the Festival of Lights. And
that didn't appear until...
Yeah, but it wasn't until about 600 A.D. that someone actually came up, some rabbi writing in one of these... opinion things that they keep around a lot, came up with this, and so he decided that what it was is what it was, a miracle, and that all that sort of stuff. Now, why do you suppose that, as they say, it needed to last for 8 days? It turns out that in order to ceremonially purify the oil, the process takes 8 days. So that's why it was supposedly a miracle that, you know, they went and started hurrying up to make the oil, but they knew they couldn't get it until next week. So they thought, well, I guess we're just going to be without oil for, you know, 7 days. And then the lamp just burned for 8 days. And that's why the menorah that they have at Hanukkah has four and four lamps or whatever. And they light candles now, but, you know, back in those days it was oil lamps. So it's got four and four, and then it's got one in the middle. And it was interesting to read what this guy had to say about that ninth one in the middle. That, well, the ninth one in the middle was there to provide light all the time. So you can see to light the candles. So because they weren't supposed to use the candles on the eight candles on the menorah to provide light for the house. It was supposed to be a ceremonial thing. So they needed another candle so they could see what they're doing. So that's why they have nine of them. So I thought, well, that's interesting. I had never heard that before. I thought, well, why are there nine? It was only 8 days. So anyway, so it's interesting, I think, that the books, the first and second books of Maccabees, do not talk about some sort of miracle of the lamps and such like as that. But it does talk about the dedication of the temple. And that's what made up this festival that they have today that we see that Jesus observed. And it was mentioned, and I forget which one it was. It's the, what was it called in the New Testament? Was the Feast of the Dedication?
Which is what Hanukkah means.
Yes. Dedication. Right. So if I go over here to Matthew, I guess. Oh, that's King James. Can't use King James. Yeah. Has anybody come across the reference yet? Oops, that's not it. Do a concordant search on here and go to dedication. Look in the New Testament. There it is. John 10:22. All right. So that's the one that he's talking about. So notice that it says the context here talked about it was the Feast of the Dedication at Jerusalem. It was winter and Jesus was walking in the temple in Solomon's porch. And so he was there in the temple on Solomon's porch. And all the New Testament is showing us here is a time frame. Now, if you read about this particular month that it was supposed to be in Kislev or whatever it was, it turns out that because the Jewish calendar is a lunar calendar, that can be anywhere from mid-November to late December. So it just occurs at different times over the years. Okay. Alright. Alright, well, that's all I got, so we're done. There's a lot of interesting stuff if you haven't taken the time to read the books of Maccabees. Not that they're worth anything scripturally speaking, and they were not included in the Hebrew Bible. As far as I know, no other Bible has considered them canonical books. They appear as an appendix, as I understand it, or are appended to the Catholic Bible, but the early, what they refer to as church fathers, referred to them as books that were useful for reference, not as books of the canon. And and you see those mentions several times through writings of the early writers of people that were actually Christians, that when they were looking at the books that were in the New Testament, the Old Testament, things like that, they would talk about books that were definitely in the canon, in other words, inspired book, and then others that were useful for study and information, and then others that were just good for reading in the assembly. In other words, it's kind of like reading poetry in the assembly or something like that. So there were like three different categories that some people had as to what books that they would include in their Bible. Remember that as Mickey was talking in one of the lessons last Sunday about Martin Luther, and he said he wouldn't have what in his Bible? He would not have that right straw, a book of James, in his Bible. And he took it out. So I guess there was a version of the Bible that Martin Luther published. And he was, what, German, I think? And apparently one of the Bibles around at that time then jumped right over the book of James. So much like the woman who didn't have Mark 16:16 in her Bible. Yeah, because a pair of scissors took care of that. All right. And You'll remember that Mickey has talked several times about a study that he and I had of with a neighbor of ours over on the east side of Lancaster a number of years ago that kept rejecting this book and that book of the New Testament, the Old Testament, or the New Testament rather. And finally, when it came right down to it, he would only accept certain portions of the book of John. And I go, well, if you're going to do that, you might as well just turn to Judaism. So he wouldn't accept any of the books of the New Testament past the Gospels, because all those people were influenced by Paul, and he was not a good guy to you know, be influenced by. All right. Okay, so what lesson am I in? That's 39. I don't want 39. We go to lesson 40. We're talking about the fact that the time is drawing near. And Mickey has covered certainly a lot of this in the class previously. I get lesson 40 up here. But right in the middle here, we talk about, let's see how Daniel's prophecy is coming true. And because we mentioned this, I wanted to make sure that we understood that when we look at Daniel's prophecy, we have how many kingdoms mentioned? And what four kingdoms are they? Okay. And it's difficult as we look through the scriptures and such, especially since the Grecian kingdoms were in the times of biblical silence, to really say, well, what do you mean Greek empire or Greek kingdom? I mean, where is the kingdom of Greece? And we see this when we look at the Ptolemies and the Seleucids and the Attalids and the whatever that other one was. So we see there that indeed there was what you would refer to as a Grecian empire. It was not united in the way that we would think of most empires, but what it was is that it was an influential set of kingdoms that was around for quite a number of years, from the early 300s BC all the way up until the 50s BC, before Rome became dominant. So it's important for us to realize that though we can identify the Babylonian kingdom very easily, we can identify the Medo-Persian Empire very easily, it's difficult for us to look at the Grecian Empire and say what it is. And so that's why I feel that we need to look at these things and realize that there indeed was what we could call a Grecian Empire. Randy?
Since we're studying this, when you look at Daniel chapter 11,
Daniel 11,
several of the passages seem to make sense when applied to the history of the study.
Yeah.
Beginning in verse 2, well, I guess we start in verse 2. In the first year, Darius the Mede, I arose to be encouragement and protection.
There we go.
In verse 2, and now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings are going to arise in Persia. But the fourth will gain far more riches than all of them. As soon as he becomes strong through his riches, he will arouse the whole empire against the realm of Greece. And the mighty king will arise, and he will rule with great authority and do as he pleases. But as soon as he has arisen, his kingdom will be broken up and parceled out toward the four points of the compass, though not to his own descendants, nor according to his authority which he wielded. For his sovereignty will be uprooted and given to others besides them. Well, that's what that sounds like, Alexander and his four generals.
Yeah, right, exactly. I think we mentioned that back when we were studying Daniel. I'm not sure how much detail that I recall that we went into, but yeah, that's exactly. And when was Daniel written? I think we discussed that last week. Wasn't it like 600?
539 in the first year of Darius. I wrote 539.
Okay.
circa 605 to 534.
Okay, right. So it takes quite a while to go through the book of Daniel, because we're looking at the expulsion of the Jews in 606 B.C., with the first taking away by Nebuchadnezzar. And then by the time we get done, we're in the Medo-Persian Empire. Yeah. David?
Yeah. I think Josephus is the one who mentioned that, the Jews cut away with Alexander and they did with the Romans. They had the privileges that a lot of the other captive nations didn't have.
Yeah.
And Josephus mentions that when Alexander came in, not the first time to take Jerusalem on the way to Egypt, he didn't because the priests supposedly went out and showed him Daniel chapter 8. But it didn't really say what chapter, but then chapter 8 mentions Greek.
Yeah.
He's a mighty Greek king. And so he thought that it was him and he was going to conquer the Persian. So he left Jerusalem alone.
Okay.
And stuff. So, and then, of course, under the Roman Empire, a Jew could worship on the seventh day, even if he was a soldier of their own army. So Jews had some privileges there also.
Yeah. And it turns out that... Right, right. Antiochus III, Epiphanes' dad, he made sure that when he was ruler over Palestine that the Jews could worship the way they wanted to and all that sort of stuff. But I think that he and his son finally determined that these traditional Jews were just not getting along very well with the Hellenistic Jews. And they felt that some sort of, civil war was going on. They need to go and fix it. And of course, as we see, when you look at the Roman Empire, one thing that I've always noticed is that, a lot of people will say that, Pontius Pilate, when he washed his hands of Jesus, he was being weak and all that sort of stuff. But the fact of the matter is that if you weren't part of the elite ruling class, you were less than completely human. And to kill somebody out of hand was no problem for the king. Pontius Pilate didn't want to see a riot go, which would take more time and money for him and such like as that. So he's looking at it for sort of from a ruling and economic point of view. And so all these people are shouting, "Crucify him, crucify him." And he says, "Well, okay, fine, whatever." He didn't consider Jesus or anybody else under his rule to be... Oh, yes, please. Right here on top of that pillar. didn't consider anybody else to be... really 100% human. They were just they were just tools to use. Jared, did you have your hand up for anything? Hey, ring the bell now. Okay. And so it's interesting that when we look at this, as a matter of fact, if we go back and look at the Ptolemaic dynasty that was in Egypt, their avowed purpose of going in and taking over Egypt was to Hellenize it. And that's exactly what they did. But they became, as I mentioned, Egyptized in the same time. So there were trade-offs here. But the thing is that wherever these went, the Ptolemies or the Seleucids or the Attalids or the other guys, what they did was they brought their culture with them. They brought their language with them. And they really affected the people that were there, and these people became more Hellenistic than they actually thought that they were getting.
The Ptolemies, I think, was the second one. He had two half-brothers. They actually ruled in Macedonia, the other empire. I forgot the name of the general. They usually call it the Macedonian Empire Dynasty. And they actually ruled in there.
Oh, yeah.
There were some ties with Macedonia even after, the split and stuff. There were still ties with that.
Yeah.
To the, I guess you call it, the motherland or whatever. But, most of the time they were separate entities, and then sometimes they were fighting, sometimes they weren't fighting.
And Macedonia, of course, was really rather small compared to some of the others. You know, the Seleucid Empire, I think that's the one that they said that this that took up like 2 million square miles or something yeah. like that. It was much the same size as the... Didn't we say that the Persian Empire was about that big?
Yeah,
so they, at their biggest reign, but then that map that we... Is it in here, chapter 40? Yeah, the map that you have on page 162, the command that Pompey and some of the generals of the Roman Empire got was to go secure the entire perimeter of the Mediterranean to at least 50 miles inland. And so that map that you've got on page 162 shows pretty much that they went around and did that. What was one of the things that really helped, besides the Romans' foot soldiering power, what was one other thing that really helped them? Yeah, their navy. So they had a navy that could actually do something. And so that's when that's why they were able to... actually, I think we have it here. Yeah, this one right here. Hello. So this map right here, which is not showing up with a lot of distinguishment of color here, but you see that as they went around the Mediterranean, they just went around and just secured land. And there wasn't any reason for them to secure this because it's all desert. Nobody lives there anyway. It's kind of like living in Lancaster. Nobody wants it. So so though why they'd want Libya, I'm not sure either. But still... So that's what the Romans did, and they managed to gather a lot of land up, and of course, part of that, of course, was taking Palestine. So, okay, I think according to the clock on the computer, we're out of time. So, I've rambled and such long enough. We'll try and have a more codified class next week, but make sure that you've read through lesson 40. And we should have already passed out questions for Lesson 40 that are not in the book. And I've emailed out Lesson 40 to those of you that are on my email list. So if you didn't get a copy of the questions for Lesson 40, please see me and I'll get you a copy. All right. Thank you very much.